Good day. This is Shane Hasty for the InfoQ Culture Podcast. I'm here with Alex Chin. Alex recently gave a great talk at QCon London. Oh, remind me of the title of the talk, Alex.
Shaving My Head Made Me a Better Programmer.
Which was absolutely intriguing. Alex, before we get in, would you mind briefly introducing yourself?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I'm a Brooklyn-based software engineer and educator, and I work a lot on access to computer science education and leveraging technology to create positive social change. Right now, I lead the web engineering team at Skillshare, which is a continuing education platform. And I also teach at the Code Cooperative, which is an educational program that I founded in which former inmates learn to code as a means of creating social change.
Cool. So some pretty intriguing and interesting things there. How did you get into this? What brought you down this social change path?
Oh, that's a great question. I've always been passionate about, changing my environment for the better. And started out like on a very small scale, just like within my space, my neighborhood, my organization. But as I started developing software professionally, I learned via my own experiences about some larger injustices that exist in the world. And I became very passionate about addressing those using my skills and my expertise.
Tell us a little bit of the story behind the talk that you gave at QCon recently.
Certainly, yeah. The title is a little bit misleading. So I started programming in college. I'm originally from France, and I moved to the United States for university. And I took a programming class kind of by chance and fell in love with it immediately and decided to major in computer science and become a software engineer. And as I was starting a little bit later than other people in my program, and as I was one of the only women in my program, I soon realized that, you know, I was being treated differently. People didn't necessarily want to work with me or interact with me on an intellectual level. People continuously made comments like, oh, you know, are you sure you're a software engineer? Prove it. Do you know what a terminal is? Just like I was continuously having to work perhaps twice as hard in order to be accepted in my industry. And these kind of forms of discrimination really continued and escalated as I entered the professional software engineering field. And they became so prevalent that I decided, and the reason was that I was extremely feminine. I didn't fit into the mold of what a typical programmer looks like. And so I reached a turning point where I decided to shave my head because I was really tired of being discriminated against just because of the way that I looked. And after I shaved my head, the funniest thing happened. Overnight, I became a really great programmer. And I mean, my skills didn't actually change, but my peers, other programmers, they looked up to me for technical expertise, and I stopped getting, you know, sexually harassed at tech events. And so at that moment, I realized that I'd always been an excellent programmer, and that the way people were treating me was solely because of my gender. And that made me realize that I needed to contribute something more to our community. I wanted to make sure that this kind of discrimination wouldn't be perpetuated. And I decided to start teaching people who don't fit the status quo, women, people of color, immigrants, people without college degrees, to code, so that at some point there would be many more of us who don't fit the mold of what a programmer looks like in the field of software, and you wouldn't be able to say that person doesn't look like a programmer. And kind of that's the mission that I've been on ever since then.
From your experience as a person who has been at that end and made that change, what's driving this? Why do we have this behavior? Because if we look at the history of our industry, it was one of the least discriminatory right at the beginning.
That's a really good question. You're absolutely right. And there were a lot of women in software in the beginning of software. Computer science was thought to have been actually invented by a woman.
Ada Lovelace.
Ada Lovelace, yes. And the first computers, as it were women. It was considered to be a women-oriented job. And in the 80s, we saw a huge drop in women programming. And the reason is that early personal computers were being marketed towards men. They were kind of perceived as toys. You could play Pong or simple shooting games and maybe do some word processing. And it was just entirely marketed to men and boys. And so at that point, the whole concept of the boy genius programmer kind of emerged. And since then, at that point, you can see a steady decline of women in computer science.
That's really sad because we're losing out on diverse viewpoints and fantastic skills.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So what is it? Is it just that individuals are bigoted and biased?
No, individuals aren't born bigoted and biased. However, we learn a lot from the messages that we receive from the media, from our environments, and it's extremely hard to unlearn those unconscious biases, right? Unconscious biases are like shortcuts that our minds create in order to easily access information. So if my whole life I've seen from TV and movies and advertising that, you know, computers are for boys and makeup is for women, then that's a shortcut that I will have in my mind. And it actually takes a lot of effort to unlearn these biases. And the first step to kind of unlearning them is just recognizing that you have them. So recognizing that sexism in tech is an issue and that we all contribute to it. And there have been studies that have shown that people can have unconscious biases against groups that they even belong to.
So that social conditioning is incredibly powerful. What is the nature of the system and how do we fix the system?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what system are you referring to?
Is it our social system? Is it our education system? Is it the, you mentioned the mass media? Why? How do we break this down to a point where we can do something about it?
Well, you know, changing the system is a big task, and there are issues within every piece of it, education, media, I mean, the professional sphere, within families. The best way to change the way that people think and the way that people experience life, to start small, start with your community, and surely enough, that movement will grow.
So what are some practical things that somebody listening to this could do?
Yeah, I assume that folks who are listening to this are probably tech workers or software engineers, so they probably work at tech companies. And there's a lot you can do if you care about creating a more inclusive space within your community. So the first piece of advice I always give is to kind of find why you care about this issue. And the reason shouldn't be, you know, because of bad PR or because you have to or because you think it's charitable. There are some really great reasons to care about diversity and inclusion. For example, if you want your team to make a lot of money, studies have shown that diverse teams always outperform non-diverse teams and that teams with more racial diversity just like make a lot more money. Similarly, teams with gender diversity are much more efficient. So if you care about having a great team that brings in a lot of revenue and that's innovative, you should care about diversity. If you care about building a great product, we've seen that products that have been released that have been built by homogenous teams can have severe blind spots. Like, for example, when Apple Health launched without menstrual cycle tracking, or Apple Maps launched without public transportation. Or for a more egregious example, when Google Images launched and their image recognition tagged Black people as gorillas just because they hadn't tested with enough photos of Black people. And that could have easily been avoided if the team hadn't been so homogenous. And most importantly, you know, you can care because it affects your bottom line and because you want to build a great product that serves the whole world. But you should care because lack of diversity in the tech industry is just a symptom of, you know, the systemic discrimination that exists in our entire world. And if we care about equality, then we should care about fixing tech's lack of diversity. But in terms of practical advice, first thing that everyone should do is just gather data. So the community that you're a part of, your group of, like, your meetup, your company, find out what are the diversity metrics. You know, how many women are on your team? How many people of color? How many immigrants? How many people who are older? How many people who are LGBTQ? And just, like, that will give you a great map for where you should be focusing your efforts. It's really difficult to measure success of your efforts if you don't know where you started. So I'd say the first step is definitely to gather some data.
Okay, but those are going to be embarrassing numbers for many organizations.
Yes, but the good news is that everyone's numbers are embarrassing. I'm very proud of the work that we've done in terms of diversity and inclusion at Skillshare. Our engineering team is 40% women and 60% people of color. We have a small team. Our engineering team is about 20 people. But most tech companies have embarrassing numbers, so that shouldn't deter someone from gathering data. And you don't have to release it publicly. It's just, you know, it's a great way to just show to your leadership team or just to yourself, like, wow, if, you know, for example, I'm taking New York City. If 50% of New York City are Black and Latino and our engineering team is only 5% Black or Latino, that means that we're really missing a lot of talent. And then once you've gathered initial data, it's very important to gather data about your hiring processes. Find out how many people from underrepresented groups you reach out to, how many people submit resumes, how many people make it past that round, how many people make it past the technical interview, how many people make it past the cultural interview, how many people do you make an offer to. And then you can identify within your processes where are you unintentionally inserting bias.
So again, do some root cause analysis and the skills that we're all taught to.
Exactly. We're, you know, in the tech industry, we really pride ourselves on being data-driven. So let's be data-driven when it comes to issues of diversity and inclusion.
Let's, if we can, explore the unconscious bias in the employment process. How do we fix that? And how does it not become tokenism? Because that's a constant challenge, you know. You know, I've got to employ X number of whatevers because. So it's treated almost as tokenism.
That's a great question. And tokenism is an issue. I would say the point at which tokenism isn't a problem, is no longer a problem, is when you reach critical mass of folks from underrepresented backgrounds. At that point, folks who are from underrepresented backgrounds on your team are just human beings once they're not like the one woman on the team. So it's really important to really reach that level of critical mass. But there's also like an easy way to avoid these types of efforts becoming tokenism, which is just being authentic in your efforts and trying to make a change, not because you have to or because you think you have to, but rather because you care about solving issues of inequality. Then the product of that won't be tokenism. In terms of solving these issues within our hiring processes and removing bias, I mean, the first step is to recognize that it's possible to have, you know, unconscious bias within the hiring process, which is a harder thing than it sounds to admit. I mean, none of us want to admit that we're unintentionally sexist or racist or homophobic, but, you know, the truth is that most of us are, and none of us are perfect. And so if we can admit that we are prone to biases and we're prone to making mistakes, and we're okay with rethinking our processes, then it gets easier. For example, one thing that's really helped at Skillshare is having a set rubric of skills and values that we evaluate candidates for. That way we're you know, trying our best to evaluate everyone in the same way. And we have a grading scale for how people score on each of these skills and values. And we have a map for how people should score others. And we train people heavily on how to interview folks. We always interview with two people at once to try and remove as much bias there. We try to have people from all different backgrounds in the interview process as well. One really great life hack is to eat before you interview someone, because you're actually more prone to giving into your biases when you're tired and hungry, because it takes effort to combat them. And honestly, just continuously revisiting your processes, just like being okay with saying, you know what, I feel like we might be missing some really great people at this step of the process. Like, how can we make it better? Thinking about things like, does my interview process favor people who are extroverts over introverts? You know, thinking about whether certain questions play on some cultural differences, asking yourself questions like that.
So deep self-examination.
Definitely. And it's hard. But if you have a team that's committed to making positive change, then it can be done.
Thank you for that. Talking about a team that's committed to making positive change, tell us about the Code Cooperative, please.
Yeah, the Code Cooperative is my passion project. Before founding it, I have been teaching people to code, adults and children of all ages, for a few years. I had been the curriculum director of a programming school for adults from underrepresented backgrounds. And so I've been just extremely passionate about teaching and education and providing access to computer science education to all for a long time. And I was really intrigued about the possibility of designing learning experience in which people learn to code, not just to enrich themselves, but to transform the world through technology, to make a positive impact on their communities using their own lived experience, because really, the people who are the best equipped to solve problems are the ones who experience them. Mm-hmm. And so that was the idea for the Code Cooperative. Mm-hmm. And I launched the inaugural class in October of 2016, so not long ago. Mm-hmm. And I partnered with this nonprofit called the Fortune Society, based in Queens, in New York, that provides prison reentry services. And so all the students of the Code Cooperative were recently released from prison. And most of them had been in prison for a long time. We started with a class of 6 people. And the goal of the class was to teach these folks to code to support their reentry out of prison, but also to start to address issues that they'd experienced within the criminal justice system, because they have this unique perspective, this unique experience, to address them by building projects, by building, like, you know, code projects that would take a shot at solving them.
And how's it going?
It's going well. So we've only had one pilot class with 6 participants so far. The class ran for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the participants all learned a ton. We only had the time to meet about once a week for the first 3 months for a couple hours. And then once my relationship grew with the Fortune Society, we were able to meet twice a week. Once a week we did a lecture, and the other time we spent like 4 hours at like various tech companies in New York doing office hours. And they all learned the basics of web development, so building websites with HTML and CSS. They all deployed those websites to the internet using GitHub, and they all their projects, their final projects, addressed one issue that they'd identified within the criminal justice system. So for example, have a student who built a project called the Criminal Injustice System, mm-hmm. that kind of highlighted the ways in which prison did not rehabilitate, but rather oppress him and all the people that have been imprisoned. I have another student who built a project that mapped the legacy of slavery to the current system of mass incarceration in the United States. Another student who was diabetic, and so his project was about issues of nutrition in prison, really, really interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about continuing this program and having another class of students, hopefully very soon. One thing that was really exciting is that we were able to get laptop donations from tech companies from around New York so that all the students could have and own their own laptop, because one of the key components of learning to code is having access to a computer and the internet, you know, whenever you want to practice. And so we're really, or I've been really thankful for the sponsorships from companies like Kickstarter, Donors Choose, Thrillist, Giphy. Yeah.
Sounds like some interesting stuff and things that are tackling pretty hard end of the social problems that we face. So when you said leveraging technology for social change, you mean it.
Yeah, I think that technologists, most of us, we care about making a positive difference in the world. And that's why we, you know, started coding or started building things, you know, because we like fixing problems, because we're dreamers, mm-hmm. and because we want to make the world a better place. Especially in the United States right now, and actually across the world, there's a huge movement for the resistance. Almost every technologist I speak to wants to leverage their skills to make a positive difference. And the Code Cooperative is a great example of how, you know, one person with an idea can impact a few people's lives who they themselves can, like, change the world.
So, Alex, you've really given us lots of food for thought. You mentioned, as a single individual, this is something that you chose to do, and you went and found a nonprofit, and you've found something you're passionate about. You've also provided advice for our listeners in terms of things they can do internally with their organizations. If somebody's listening to this and I want to do something, yeah, this makes sense to me. What else can I do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's a question I get all the time. I will say, if you're a technologist and you're able-bodied, you know, there's a lot you can do for social good. I mean, even if you're not able-bodied, but I would say if you make a tech salary, you have to be donating money to causes that you care about. You should look at your area of expertise and your sphere of influence. And that's really where you can start making a difference. Like, what are the skills that only you have? Who are the people that you have access to? And think about what's the impact that you can make with those two things. And then definitely you should call things out that you see in your environment when things happen that are wrong, especially if you are someone who has more privilege. If you see someone from an underrepresented group experiencing any unconscious or even conscious discrimination, it's your job to speak up and to show up and, you know, shield those who can't necessarily shield themselves with your voice and your body.
Well, Alex, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. As I said, lots of food for thought. If people wanted to get hold of you, how can they do so?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Alex Chin. My personal website is alexq.in, and I'm pretty accessible if people want to tweet at me. I would encourage everyone to visit codecooperative.org if they want to support my educational program.
Again, thanks very much.
Thank you, Shane. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I had a great time.